I'm Charlie Rose.
I'm Nora O'Donnell.
And I'm Gail King. Hey, this is a CBS This Morning podcast.
Welcome to the CBS This Morning podcast. I'm Vladimir Dutis, CBS News correspondent. Today, I'm really excited to be joined by Liza Mundy. Liza is a New York Times bestselling author and former Washington Post reporter. She has this really fascinating new book out that is called Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So I really wanted to get you on the podcast to talk about this book because it's one of the most fascinating subjects of the war, World War II specifically. And I think that in this day and age when, for whatever reason, and maybe it's because we're more woke as a country, that the contributions of people, women, minorities, minority women, to the cause of freedom, to the cause of democracy in this country has become something that we are highlighting more and more with, you know, the films that have come out recently with regards to the space race. And so this is just another fascinating untold story, as is in the title of the book, about these incredible women who I love how, and I'm probably giving a bit of it away here, but that how it was a woman who actually learned that World War II had ended before anybody else knew that,
right? Translating the Japanese diplomatic messages, announcing that, you know, that Japan was about to surrender. It was a woman who translated that message.
Yeah.
So she knew before anybody
And she
else.
Knew before anybody else, mm-hmm. before the president yep. of the United States
Correct.
Himself knew, right?
Yep.
So that's yep. Just that alone is yep. an incredible story. So how did you stumble on the story?
I was reading a declassified history of one of the smaller code-breaking projects and went out to the NSA, the National Security Agency, because that is the agency that grew out of the World War II code-breaking operation, which was incredibly successful. We won the war, right?
And it was a good thing.
Yeah. And when I talked to the historians there, they laid out for me this extraordinary untold story of more than 10,000 women who had been secretly recruited to come to Washington, college undergraduates, school teachers from the South, educated, smart women who participated in and comprised more than half of our code-breaking force. And I was amazed that the story hadn't been told. And the reason it hadn't been told was it was top secret during the war. They kept it secret after the war because we continued to, listen in to enemy messages, or during the Cold War, you know, certainly Soviet messages and Eastern European. So it stayed secret. The women had been told to keep the secret and they kept it. I mean, I had to pull the story out of some of the 90-something-year-old women who I interviewed. They were still reluctant to use certain words that they had been told never to say in public.
That's incredible. And so I'm guessing the women were recruited because men were off fighting the war,
right.
And there were a lot of women that were at home. And we've always focused on Rosie the Riveter,
right?
That's been a big part of the consciousness of this country, even going back to the early days of the war. But this was not something that was as well known. And I'm curious, is that how they were recruited?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Pearl Harbor obviously was the surprise attack that got us into the war, but it also exposed this just incredible intelligence deficit that it came as a surprise. And so the U.S. Navy was in chaos. There was a lot of recrimination. They knew that we needed to ramp up our intelligence efforts instantly. And just as you say, the men were signing up, scrambling to recruitment stations and shipping out to fight. And there's actually a document in the National Archives that I found from the U.S. Navy intelligence operation. And it said on it, new source, women's colleges. Mm. And so somebody got the idea, well, we'll tap this untapped source of educated women. And so the Navy began sending secret letters to college seniors at certain universities, the Seven Sisters schools on the Northeastern Seaboard, but other schools as well, like Goucher College in Baltimore. The young women were invited to secret meetings where they were asked two questions. Do you like crossword puzzles? And are you engaged to be married? And if they said yes to the second and no to the first, no to the second, they were invited to spend their senior year in a secret training course learning how to do cryptanalysis.
Did they have any, were they looking, other than those two questions, were there any other attributes? I know that, for example, the CIA recruited men from Ivy League schools,
right.
Historically, that had been
right.
Where they had gone to look for recruits. and they might have searched or looked, been on the lookout for specific skills. Was that the same case here with the women?
Yes, they were looking for women who had taken, who had a good liberal arts education. And so they were looking for women who with aptitude in language and math, but they were also looking for loyalty. And, you know, they did extensive background checks of the women. And meanwhile, the U.S. Army was hotly competing for educated women as well. And because the Navy had sort of sewn up the Northeast, the Army went to the South and the Midwest looking for school teachers, because a college-educated woman in 1941 had really pretty much one job that was available to her, and that was teaching school. So the Army sent handsome young officers to post office and hotels around the South and the Midwest, and under the idea that Southern women in particular were susceptible to the charms of a handsome man. And I interviewed a number of these school teachers, and in fact, some of them were trying to get out of hasty engagements, and they were very eager to come to Washington and serve the war effort.
So one of the things we've also, as we've become more aware of the contributions of men who were perhaps gay, minorities, women and men, who contributed to the war effort, one of the things that we always learn about is how they were sort of marginalized after the war ended, or their exploits were not widely documented because they were sort of perhaps not dispensable, but disposable in the way that people thought of them. Did you find that with these women?
Yes. Yes. That is the case. And I should also say that once the waves and the WACs were created, once women were admitted into the military, it wasn't just these small targeted groups of women who were contributing. Any enlisted woman who tested well for aptitude would be funneled into these enormous code-breaking operations that were secretly taking place in Washington. So it was, in the end, a much more diverse group than at first. But it's also true that the women were, they were given medals after the war. They were told never to show them to anybody. They were encouraged to go back home and get married and, you know, raise a family and never tell anybody what they did. And so a lot of these women, I mean, just as you say, they were marginalized. They didn't stay in the work after the war. And they had to sort of sit at the dinner table while their husband regaled the children with tales of what he had done in the war.
Right, that's...
And out of patriotism and believing that they were doing the right thing, they kept quiet about what they did. But I should say also that there was a cohort of women who did stay with the work. There were women who went to graduate school on the GI Bill, the women who had been with the Navy and got graduate degrees, PhDs, went into teaching, stayed in the STEM field. And there was also a cohort of women who went on to work for the NSA, the National Security Agency. And the first female deputy director of the NSA was a 22-year-old college senior recruited into the code-breaking effort. So she came out of the World War II code-breaking effort. So there was this unseen generation of women in the intelligence community in Washington who came out of the war service.
We've heard also about, for example, Navajo codebreakers,
yes.
Different groups of Americans who were recruited by the precursor to the CIA and the NSA, the OSS, to partake in these codebreaking activities. Did they all ever get together, or was there a concerted effort to, were they in the same room, or were they just kept separate? Did they know that there were other efforts underway?
Right. So this was very compartmentalized, and it seems unlikely to me that the women who were doing the codebreaking knew about the Navajo code talkers. They were doing cybersecurity. Basically, the code talkers were in encoding our communications so the enemy couldn't listen in. Now, there were women who did that as well, and you're exactly right to equate the groups, because they show that, you know, during a time of national emergency, we were perfectly willing to avail ourselves of the communication skills and talents of these marginalized groups, and then at the end of the war to say, well, you know, thank you very much for your service, and don't ever tell anybody what you did.
Right.
You know, I did come across an oral history of a woman who went to the Naval communications training school, which is very secret, at Mount Holyoke, and she talked about learning the Navajo language to do the code talking. So that's a piece of the story that I'd like to try to follow. She said that there actually weren't enough people who knew the Navajo language. They were actually teaching some people. So it may be that some women did do that work.
That's so fascinating.
Yeah.
And I wonder now, so how are they, the ones that are still around, right? Yes. I mean, what are they like? Is there one or two in particular that stand out to you?
Oh, absolutely. And I must say, I've become very attached to this generation of women. You know, they were girls during the Depression. They've really seen it all.
Yeah.
And Pearl Harbor happened in many cases when they were 21, so their youth was exploded by that. And yet so committed, so patriotic, so just kind of fierce and tough. There was one woman who here in the Washington area at an assisted living facility, and she liked to have our interviews over Bloody Marys at the exactly. And one day when the subway broke down, because she had to take several means of conveyance even to get there, it broke down, and so she stood in line for the bus. I mean, just the strength and fortitude of these women in their mid-90s was an extraordinary thing to see. But and also pulling the stories out of them.
They don't want to talk.
No, they really played by the rules. Yeah. Even in the 80s and 90s when some of the men started writing memoirs of their code-breaking exploits. So even when other people started playing by other rules, the women played by the rules. But they also, at this point, very much would like credit. One of the women I interviewed, my central character, Dot Braden, when I was trying to persuade her that it's okay to talk, at one point she said, well, you know, what are they going to do to me at this age? Put me in prison?
Right.
And I said, you know, at your age, it would probably be a nice prison. And, yeah. And she laughed at that.
But you know what, what would happen right now, Liza, is anybody 5 years after the war would write a book and then they'd do a movie. And
oh, my gosh. You know, I mean, you have CIA directors who leave and immediately
start writing
books.
They go on the talk show circuit. Right?
Kiss and tell. Exactly. And it is extraordinary that they kept mum for decades. And many of the women obviously took it to their graves. And one woman I interviewed, she said, I just hope I live long enough to see this book published.
Wow. And did that include like their own families, their husbands,
absolutely,
their children, their grandchildren? Yeah. They wouldn't show off their medals and say, I did. No.
No. And sometimes they would start hinting around at what they did. You know, when the book started being published, they realized that some other people were talking. And I have to say, it was, you know, male naval officers and men who were writing about this and historians. And so they realized that the story was out, and they would start telling their families a little bit, but they would never reveal what they did exactly or use certain words like overlap, which was a term of art that they had to overlap the messages. They wouldn't use words like that or describe exactly what they did because they were concerned about revealing sources and methods. And that may seem sort of ridiculous 75 years hence, but what they were doing was decryption. I mean, they were working with encrypted messages, and they were decrypting them. They were hacking enemy communication systems. And of course, it's much of it's done digitally by computer today, but it's still decryption.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you, and I think I know the answer to this, but I'm just curious as being a reporter, I'm guessing that all the women were white. They in an age now where we know that there were, for example, mathematicians who were African American women who participated in the NASA in the race for space. That I'm guessing back then in 1940, 1941, most of the women who would have participated in this, at least the recruits would have been white.
Mostly, but there was an African American unit in the Army code breaking operation. Civilians. Most of the people in the Army code breaking operation, the school teachers, remained civilians, which was good in the sense it made for a less hierarchical workplace. So if you were a really bright 22-year-old woman, you'd be put in charge of a cybersecurity unit, and they were. So there was an African American unit, mostly female, and they were working the codes of companies and banks that were also transmitting in ciphered communications. You know, all these communications going on during this global war were going on over telegraph mostly or through the radio waves, through the air. And so companies and banks, just as now, were also in ciphering their communications. So the African American unit was monitoring these communications to find out who in this country or in the allied countries was doing business with Hitler or with Japanese companies like Mitsubishi, because that was illegal. They weren't supposed to be doing it. So they were keeping tabs on the private sector.
Wow, that's fascinating. Yeah. I had no idea. So
there's a photo in my book of that unit.
Oh, see, yeah. I need to.
That's
like,
right.
That,
no,
I got to
no.
go through that because yeah. that's just so cool.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
interesting.
And I'd like to know more about that unit too. The records were a little scanty, but I bet they exist somewhere, or I bet there's a family in the D.C. area who knows that their grandmother did this work. So I look forward to pursuing that as well.
Well, maybe they'll listen to this podcast
and they'll
say my grandmother, mm-hmm. or if you said there were some men too that were in that unit,
yep.
maybe they know something about that. And that leads me to my question about research. I mean, given that the women themselves were reluctant to talk about their responsibilities and the activities that they participated in during the war, how was it researching this subject? I mean, how much time did you spend in the National Archives? I mean, were there even any, I don't know, were there any files that would hint at what was going on?
Oh my gosh, the files, you wouldn't believe how many files there were.
Really?
And I should say that the women were reluctant at first.
Okay.
But once they started talking, they talked and talked. I mean, my central character, I interviewed her at least 20 times. And another woman who was reluctant, I stayed in her apartment for 2 days. So once they started talking, there was no shortage. And their memories were so extraordinary that I ended up spending 3 months in the National Archives looking through their extensive records. There were way more than I thought there'd be. And it was amazing how well they substantiated what the women recollected. So I interviewed a woman on Cape Cod who showed me the math that she had to do to decrypt the Japanese naval messages. And she remembered certain terms that they were looking for, like a Shogoichi message was a message in which a Japanese ship would announce where it would be at noon the next day, which is a perfect piece of intelligence for an American submarine commander. He would be waiting there and right. He would sink the ship. And they did over and over and over. She remembered that it was called a Shogoichi message, and she remembered the math that she did. So when I got to the National Archives and was looking through the naval records, you know, there it was all over the place in the memo, Shogoichi message, Shogoichi wow. message. And the math she was doing was called recovering additives. She was basically stripping the numerical encryption out of the messages. And I saw references to that all over the records also. So I was really surprised at how extensive the paper records were and how well they substantiated the details that the women remembered.
And that leads me to another question, which is when you learn about the history of World War II, we know of moments. We say, okay, here's how Eisenhower planned Operation Overlord, right? And but there had to have been specific incidents that happened that were a direct result of what these women were doing. For example, how did we know that Admiral Yamamoto's plane was going to be where it was
right.
to be able to blow it out of the sky? I'm guessing,
yep.
I don't know, I'm not that far in the book yet,
yep.
but I'm guessing that might have been some kind of a code that was transmitted and
absolutely.
That we, right? And
yeah.
were they connected
yes,
to that?
So, absolutely.
But beyond those, like, what other interesting moments that everybody who's familiar with World War II will be able to say, holy smokes,
yeah.
they were directly involved in yeah. that operation.
So how much time do you have? So obviously the first great, really great victory of the Pacific War was the Battle of Midway.
Yes.
And that was a code-breaking triumph. It put code-breaking on the map in the U.S. Navy, and it was seen as, you know, the first great payback for Pearl Harbor. And that was the reason that we could get into that code system was because of a Texas math teacher named Agnes Driscoll, who had worked that code during the 1930s, completely diagnosed it and mastered it and understood how it worked. The Japanese had changed their code books right before Pearl Harbor, so we had lost the ability to read the code, but we knew how it worked, and we got back into it. And so by the time of Midway, you know, that was the reason that we were able to read those messages. So that's one.
Wow.
Just as you say, less than a year later, when messages were decoded that told exactly where Admiral Yamamoto was going to be during an inspection tour, and he was the great mastermind and architect of Pearl Harbor, it was men in the Pacific and women in Washington who were working together to decrypt those messages, which came out in a couple of different code systems, and put together his itinerary, you know, to the second. And he was known for being very punctual. So several of the women alluded to the Yamamoto shoot down as, you know, as a day when cheering broke out
wow.
in the code breaking facility in Washington, D.C. So that's just two. But it's the one that people really don't know as much about, but that was every bit as important, was the daily sinking of the Japanese supply ships that were supplying the Japanese army on all of the islands that they had captured and all of the land that they held in the Pacific. And it was these school teachers, these civilian school teachers in the army operation who were reading those messages every day. The information would go out to the American submarine commanders, and they would sink those Marus. And that was women who were generating that intelligence. And that was as important as Midway. It wasn't, you know, a single cataclysmic battle. It was a day-to-day battle of attrition. So it doesn't get as much publicity. Sorry to go on at length, but
no,
we can talk about the Atlantic Ocean, and anybody who's seen The Imitation Game
right.
probably knows about the German naval codes generated by the Enigma machine. After Alan Turing's great breakthrough, the Germans changed the design of the machine, and the Americans began to take over that code-breaking operation because we had to build more sophisticated machines to break the code once the Japanese changed their machines. And again, it was women who were running that operation by 1944 here in this country, and really clearing the Atlantic Ocean of the U-boats that had been preying on our convoys, so that we could send all the men and material over for the D-Day landings. It was a Japanese diplomatic code that a woman had broken that was giving us information about where the fortifications were on the coast of Normandy, so that we knew where was the best place for the landing to take place. So that intelligence. And it was also a group of women who were creating what was known as dummy traffic, which was fake U.S. military traffic that fooled the Germans into thinking the landing was going to happen in a different part of France. So again, I could go
all those things that you've mentioned are things that, as I said, we read in the history books and we know about them, and we don't know all the details because, you know, let's face it, a lot of the history books are written by men,
right?
and so the exploits are what we read about, right? You know, we read about the landings and how bloody it was, and taking that hill and taking that bunker, but we don't really, until recently at least, have heard about these behind the scenes exploits. I know that there have been some things written about the women and the code breakers in London that were working
Bletchley Park.
Right, exactly. But again, this is something that's just so kind of interesting. And were most of them focused on the Pacific War, or did they ultimately end up doing both the European theater and the Pacific?
European theater and the Pacific. We had lead code-breaking responsibility in the Pacific, but increasingly during the European War, we shared, and then really, I would say, dominated the code breaking of the U-boats that the German Navy was using for its U-boats. And I have a chapter in the book actually where women in Washington are reading the German naval messages during the D-Day landing, and actually the German army messages, as the Germans are seeing the Allied ships on the horizon, you know, thousands and thousands of Allied ships. They start sending each other messages, like basically, holy, you know what?
Right.
And the women are reading this, and they know that the D-Day landing is taking place, and they're experiencing it from the point of view of the Germans.
I'm just so fascinated by this. Let's take a moment to think about. I mean, one of the things that you said is a lot of them went back to their homes and their families, and they've raised families after the end of the war. But the United States got involved in the Cold War.
Yeah.
I would think that the NSA and the CIA would want these women to stick around, or at least train a new generation of women. Did they do that or no?
Absolutely. So, as I said, there was a cohort of really successful wartime code-breaking women who stayed with the operation and became this early generation of important women at the NSA. And they were working all these Cold War code systems. They were working Soviet systems, East German systems, and also there was a woman, a former she wasn't even a school teacher because she hadn't finished college, but she was incredible, and she headed up the Cuban code-breaking system, which was considered a little bit of a backwater until the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
And she was leading the code-breaking efforts for the Cuban Missile Crisis. So they were an extremely important early cohort at the NSA. But, you know, as we've talked about earlier, women were really expected, told, and proselytized that if they had babies, then it was time to leave work, whatever they were doing, and go home. So most of the women who continued doing the NSA work didn't marry and didn't have children.
That was going to be my question, mm-hmm. which is, it was sort of the way I wanted to wrap this up is to ask you, could we ever see something like this again, in the sense that this country decides, even with some of the divisions that we have in this country, especially now, that there are people who can contribute in a meaningful fashion. In the book, I think you write that there were some of these women that outranked men.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
Which is, again, you're talking about the 40s, only, you know, less than, you know, a little over 20 years after women were allowed to vote in the United States, right? So could we see that again? And would we see, because it does sound as if women really did want to get married, you know, now there's always discussions about, well, should you have a career or should you mm-hmm. get married? And women struggle with that all the time. Some people don't, and some do. I guess you see where I'm sort of going here,
yeah.
which is that, like, it would have been hard back in 1941 to convince somebody to not ever get married. and continue to do this job, which I'm guessing is also probably kind of a lonely thing to do. I mean,
collaborative.
Is it?
Yeah, they loved it. I mean, that's what the women really missed after the war. The ones who did marry and have children, in fact, many of them wrote letters to each other for the rest of their lives because they missed each other so much.
Yeah.
And so it was a very, you know, it wasn't like code breaking is not the work of a lone genius like Alan Turing. It's the work of a big collaborative group of people. And just as you're saying, you know, we talk so much these days about diversity and inclusion, you know, rightfully so, to make the case that diverse teams do better work.
Right.
And what we saw during the war because of, you know, exigency and emergency was an inclusive mindset.
Let's invite them in.
Right. Let's invite the Navajo cold talkers in. Let's invite the women in, the Southern school teachers, the, you know, graduates of the Seven Sisters. And let's compete for them. Let's actually compete for their talents. And they form these inclusive, incredibly collaborative teams of people, you know, and again, I mean, we won the war.
Right.
So what more do you need to know? And we also provided child care during the war. So we did what was necessary to
provided child care.
And that's, you know, I have some scenes about that. I mean, the government officials were simultaneously unnerved by the thousands of young women who were getting on trains and leaving their hometowns and, you know, milling around train stations and, you know, engaging in hanky-panky in the bushes. I mean, literally, like, there are passages in the book where I speeches were made. And so they were unnerved by that, but they knew that we had to win the war. They knew that we needed women. So there was infant care, there was child care for toddlers, and there was aftercare for kids in school. So all of the things that we continue to battle for today were fully in place during the war.
Because now if somebody you work in the news business, if somebody said, look, we should have a daycare center because, you know, I'm always traveling or I'm always on.
Right.
I mean, people would look at that and say, well, you know, maybe this isn't the career for you.
Right.
But here we were, like, in the middle of Civil War.
Yeah, and so we had government-provided child care, and it was instantly withdrawn after the war, and it came to be seen as a communist phenomenon, you know, raising your children collectively. But it was up and running during the war. Not only that, the government sent social workers around to convince working mothers to put their kids in child care. They were literally saying, look, you don't want your kids running around while you're at work. It's much better for them to be in child care.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. I guess last question, second to last question is, it's probably become a cliche to say that they're the greatest generation. And I'm sure in many instances, if you ask them, you know, how they feel about their contributions to the war, they're probably very circumspect and humble and about it. But what was, as an objective observer, what do you feel the contribution of these women was to the effort to win the war?
Oh, it was enormous. I mean, just remember that neither the Germans nor the Japanese brought women in this way. And look who won the war, right? So I think, you know, when we think of the war and women, we do, just as you said, we think of Rosie the Riveter. And I think often we think, well, women were just sort of placeholders. I mean, yeah, they were building the planes, but they were sort of doing men's work and just filling that place, you know, for the returning men. But in fact, what you see is that women were doing real intelligence work driving the war. There was a group of women who broke the Japanese radio address system, and that may not sound important, but it was. It enabled us to know where the Japanese army was headquartered and where it was moving on a daily basis. And they compiled what was called an order of battle report every day that went to the Pentagon to fully give MacArthur a picture of where the Japanese army was. So they were driving the war effort. They were helping with war strategy. And again, this was happening in England as well, and it was not happening in Germany, where the Nazis were using women as breeders, and it was not happening in Japan, where the Japanese military was using women as comfort women and sex slaves. So I think, you know, a willingness to be inclusive, to avail ourselves of, you know, a diverse array of talent, of women's talent, it was so much more important, I think, than we've given it credit for. And I had many historians make this point to me, male historians who were helping me with my research, saying this to me, that, you know, we can't underestimate, the tanks and the guns and the bombs and the industrial production was very important. And of course, the bravery of soldiers and the deaths of all the Soviet soldiers. But the participation of women was everything.
It really does sound like it was. And I guess you just made me think of another question, which is, whose idea was this? Who was the, who's, you know, where did it spring from? Because it does sound, in 2017, it sounds revolutionary now. I can only imagine going to, I don't know, the president of the United States or whoever was running the OSS at the time, Pappy Boyington, I have no idea, but like saying, you know, here's what I want to do. And then going, wait a second. Yeah. I mean, it's almost as I can just see the same discussions happening around the Tuskegee Airmen. We're going to put African-American men in cockpits and somebody going, that sounds crazy, but they did it.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a great point. That's a great analogy. And as I said, there's this document where the Navy says new source, women's colleges, and it doesn't identify who came up with that idea. But it was happening simultaneously all over the country. I mean, it wasn't just the U.S. Army and the U.S. Navy recruiting for women. It was competing. It was the OSS. It was the FBI. And it was also defense plants. I mean, I came across these archives at Wellesley College from the class of 42 in which women were asked to state the work that they did during the war. They were working for Armstrong Cork, developing DDT. They were recruited to work at MIT, running analog computers. They were working for Bendix, designing radios. They were reading blueprints for Grumman aircraft. And there was so much competition suddenly for women math majors from everybody that you know, math departments had to expand, and educators were always looking for new math teachers and churning out as many female math majors as they could, even as they worried that the jobs would be taken away from the women during the war. So I don't know that the idea came from any one source, because it was just happening massively, spontaneously. There were meetings in Washington, and I got the minutes of these meetings in which the Department of Labor, you know, they were figuring out where to get educated women. And there was this really maddening quote that I found that'll speak to your point also, is the president of Goucher College, which was a very well-respected women's college in Baltimore, with a lot of urban students. He was outraged because one defense company asked him for 20 female engineering students, but also said, give us beautiful ones, for we don't want them on our hands after the war.
Some things never change.
Exactly.
Well, it's a fascinating book. I'm only in the first couple of chapters, but it reads like a screenplay. Is a movie in the works at all?
Yes. I mean, I'm happy to say it has been optioned.
Oh, my God. Yes. Congratulations. We're all excited.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's great.
Yeah.
Are you excited?
I am excited. Yeah. Very interesting.
I mean, just looking at the cover, I see like Reese Witherspoon and, you know, whoever else like playing these roles. I mean, are you involved in the screenplay?
I hope I will be. I mean, I hope I will be involved in the process. Yeah, I'm very excited about it. It's the production company that's owned by Jim Parsons, who plays one of the NASA engineers in Hidden Figures. And as you were saying at the beginning of our conversation, I think books and movies like Hidden Figures and Rise of the Rocket Girls, I'm very grateful to all of these books and movies for, I think, creating a new willingness on the part of the public to be receptive to the fact that this really happened, and these women really made these enormous contributions that they're finally getting credit for.
And I thank you for writing the book, because it's just such a great story, and I think everybody should know about it. And we want to thank you for coming here.
Thanks.
And sharing it with us. We really appreciate it. Thank you to our listeners for taking time out to listen to the CBS This Morning podcast. We obviously always want to hear from you, so please send us an email at ctmpodcast@cbsnews.com. You can provide us feedback on iTunes, and you can find us on Twitter and social media and Instagram. If you have any questions, certainly email us again, ctmpodcast@cbsnews.com. My name is Vladimir Zutit. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you the next time.
Thank you for listening. You can watch the full CBS This Morning broadcast Monday through Saturday from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. on your local CBS station.
Or you can stream it live on the CBS All Access app.
For more information, please visit cbsthismorning.com.